Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, March the 4th, 2024. And today we are continuing our discussion of the Laura Snyder seat working papers on citizenship taxation, which means that I am discussing this with Karen Alpert in Australia and Laura Snyder in Paris. So how are each of you today?
Good.
Yeah, it's doing quite nice here in Australia. I do wish it would cool down a bit. We've now gone more than 60 days with no minimum temperature below 20 degrees Celsius. Too warm.
You make it sound like, yeah, that is a bit warm. Okay, in any case, this has been a very, very interesting sequence of podcasts. So this is working paper number 9. Where we're talking about the forcible destruction of citizenship. But I think it's important here to place working paper number 9 and actually 7 and 8 in context. And I believe I'm right in saying that these are all aspects of the 14th Amendment. We're looking at how citizenship taxation is impacted by different aspects of the 14th Amendment. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I believe it is, John.
Okay. Laura, can I ask you, because who knows, somebody might be simply starting with podcast number 9, could you summarize the various aspects of the 14th Amendment and remind us of how papers 7 and 8 relate directly to those aspects?
Well, there's a lot going on in the 14th Amendment. Paper 7 and 8 are specifically about the Equal Protection Clause. And so what you have there is 7 talks about the question of strict scrutiny and how discrimination based on nationality is inherently suspect and so assumed to violate the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. And then you have Paper 8, which talks about how the 14th Amendment doesn't allow a second class of citizens to be created. And so we talk about how the U.S. nationality-based tax system creates a second class of citizens. And then we also how the 14th Amendment equal protection does not allow laws to be adopted or perpetuated in animus. So, you know, with a desire to hurt people. And so we talked about in the last podcast how the U.S. nationality based tax system was created and is perpetuated in animus. And so today we're going to talk about an element of the 14th Amendment that is not about the Equal Protection Clause, but about citizenship itself and about the part of the 14th Amendment that gives citizenship to people who are born in the United States.
So okay. That
if you're born in the United States, you have a constitutional right to U.S. citizenship based on the 14th Amendment.
Right. Okay. So what this says, I mean, you know, one thing about listening to you talk about this in these papers is that it really reinforces how complex the 14th Amendment actually is, but begins by saying all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. That certainly is a mouthful. But would you agree with me that that particular part of the 14th Amendment is completely separate from the equal protection part?
Yes, I think most people would agree to that, yeah.
Okay. So today, when we're talking about the 14th Amendment, we're focusing on the consequence, the constitutional consequence, if you will, of being born or naturalized in the United States, correct? Okay. Karen, could I ask you to pick this up from here?
Yeah, well, so as I understand it, and really you and Laura are the citizenship scholars more than I, but as I understand it, a lot of the citizenship rules in the earlier part of the 20th century would presume that certain activities you would lose your citizenship. And then there was a very important. Well, so there was, so all of these have
So you have two things going on here in terms of, if you want to look at this in terms of the tax system that we're talking about. Over the course of, you know, the past 100, 120 years, you've had a huge expansion of the tax system, and you've had a huge a contraction and expansion of citizenship. You used to have, before Chief Justice Earl Warren basically, you know, decided he didn't like it, but before that, you had a series of laws that would operate to make people under certain conditions automatically lose their U.S. citizenship if either certain things, certain life circumstances, or if they actually did certain things. So if you voted in a foreign election, you would be considered to have automatically lost your U.S. citizenship. If you served in a foreign military, if you deserted the U.S. Army, if you were a woman and you married someone who wasn't an American citizen and you lived outside the country for a certain number of years, if you were born outside the United States, a U.S. citizen, but you didn't take certain actions around age 18, then you would lose your U.S. citizenship. So there were lots of people over, you know, basically in the first half of the 20th century that lost their U.S. citizenship automatically because of these things. And there's a chart in this particular paper, working paper number nine, there's a chart that shows just how many people were losing forced expatriations, is the terminology, from 1945 up until 1977. And what you'll see from that is once you have a series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions like Schneider, like Afram, like what was the other one? Trope, Edola, which progressively made it more and more difficult, if not impossible, for a U.S. citizen to automatically lose their citizenship. You see all those forced expatriations, those numbers just plummet. So that's, and so the, what you have going on in those decisions is the U.S. Supreme Court saying, no, desertion of the army is not a good enough reason to deprive someone of their U.S. citizenship. No, being a naturalized citizen and moving outside the United States and living outside the United States is not a good enough reason to deprive them of their U.S. citizenship. And then you have Afram, where they say, no, voting in a foreign election is not a good enough reason to deprive someone of U.S. citizenship. And there you have the court, in no uncertain terms, saying that Congress cannot take actions, and this is the language the court uses, to abridge or affect citizenship conferred by the 14th Amendment. Because all of those reasons why people were losing their citizenship was on the basis of act of Congress. And you have the U.S. Supreme Court coming along and saying, no, Congress cannot, by their act, make it so that people lose their U.S. citizenship. And there's a key paragraph in Afram where the court says the 14th Amendment was designed to and does protect every citizen of this nation against a congressional forcible destruction of his citizenship, whatever his creed, color, or race. Our holding does no more than give to the citizen that which is his own, a constitutional right to remain a citizen in a free country unless he voluntarily relinquishes that citizenship. So, the point that this working paper makes, and this is also made in the article published in the Cornell Journal of Law and Public Policy called The Myths and Truths of Extraterritorial Taxation. The point that it's making is that today what you have is a series of laws and regulations adopted by Congress and the Treasury that are causing the forcible destruction of citizenship because they are placing people in a position where they feel they have no choice but to renounce, because otherwise they simply can't live normal lives. They don't have access to the material things that you need to exist in the modern world, bank accounts, title to your home, a business, etc. So that's basically what's going on in this paper, is to explain that.
Yes, I think you've glossed over the other side of the equation here, because you've got citizenship expanding as the Supreme Court says Congress can't take away citizenship willy-nilly. But on top of that, and you mentioned it, but the tax system has become more and more and more complex. So if you take 1924, when Cook v. Tate was decided as your baseline. Since then, in 1962, we've added controlled foreign corporations. I think it was 1986, they added passive foreign investment companies. You've got the exit tax. You've got, you know, the way foreign retirement accounts are being taxed. You've got a huge proliferation of forms and information returns that have to be filed. So over that same 100 years, the tax code has grown from a tiny little volume to, you know, codes and regulations fill a whole bookshelf.
That's exactly what is causing the forcible destruction of citizenship. It's those laws and regulations that make it so difficult to remain a U.S. citizen when you're living outside the United States. And you can see, so this paper number 9 talks about what Karen just talked about in a summary fashion. You can see exactly every single one of those laws in detail in a timeline in working paper number 16, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a later podcast. But that one lists every one of these laws again in detail in a timeline fashion, so you can see what happened when.
Okay, so the broader point here, though, which I think needs to be reinforced, is that it's the 14th Amendment that gives people a constitutional right to citizenship. And because citizenship is a constitutional right, and to a large extent the purpose of a constitution is to limit what government can do, that is the reason why in a forum the court struck down the automatic expatriation when somebody votes in a foreign election. In other words, the fact that it's a constitutional right puts a firewall around the right that Congress cannot interfere with generally, and certainly cannot interfere with to the extent that it forces people to abandon a right that they have. Fair statement?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly, after the Aforian decision was handed down in 1967, as far as I can tell, the State Department basically ignored it. Would you agree with that, Laura?
Well, maybe initially, but eventually they did have to take note of it. No, they did not react, you know, overnight. It took a while. But eventually they accepted that they can't keep denying passports to these people. But you must have something in mind by asking that question, John. What did you have in mind?
Vance and Teresa's case.
You talk about those. I'm not as familiar with those as you are.
Well, the way I understand what happened after 1967, and, you know, living in Canada, you know, during those years and watching this whole thing unfold, was that basically the State Department continued right along with a presumption that Congress had the right to strip people of their citizenship as per Section 349 of the Immigration Nationality Act, etc. And this went on for a period of at least 10 years until the Vance and Teresa's case, which was, you know, once again, you know, putting the Supreme Court in the position of really reading the Government the Riot Act again and saying, no, what a 4M actually meant was rather broadly that Congress simply does not have a constitutional right to strip people of their citizenship. And after that, there was, you know, a series of other cases, not Supreme Court cases, which eventually led up to took almost 20 years, 1986 amendments to the Immigration Nationality Act that specifically conditioned loss of citizenship on an expatriating act with the intention to relinquish U.S. citizenship. So I guess what I'm suggesting here is that you know, it was not one Supreme Court decision, but practically it was two Supreme Court decisions that really, I think, forced the State Department's hand on this issue, and eventually led to administrative presumptions that expatriating an act without the intention to relinquish would not result in the loss of citizenship.
It was a series of cases for sure. And for sure, you know, the papers we're talking about doesn't talk about every single one of those cases. And yeah, the State Department did not react overnight. And it wasn't until the 80s when they finally decided they were going to, you know, openly apply these decisions or comply with these decisions. But if you look at the chart in this paper 9, you see that already by the 70s, the number of people that were subject to forced expatriation had already gone to low numbers that were much lower than they were in the 50s and 60s, particularly 40s and 50s. Now, to what extent that's a result of the aftermath of World War II, you can ask. But by the 70s, the number of people being forcibly expatriated was already relatively low.
It may have been low in a relative sense,
but very high for the people subject to it, for sure. And those people's rights were still being violated, for sure.
Absolutely, there's no question about it. No question about it. And you know, I tend to see this as, you know, part of the long, long history of the United States weaponizing citizenship.
Well, I mean, I would go further with that, and I would say, yeah, if you can't have laws anymore that operate directly to deprive people of citizenship, then let's have laws that operate indirectly to deprive them of citizenship. It's a lot harder to argue that that's what's going on when it's being done indirectly. It's a lot harder to resist and to stop it.
Well, let's look at what's actually going on today. There is no question that the renunciations are, one, caused by U.S. extraterritorial laws, including aspects of the Internal Revenue Code that have nothing to do directly with paying taxes.
Yeah, that bar in particular, which isn't even in the Internal Revenue Code.
What's that, Karen?
The FBAR is not even in the Internal Revenue Code, and that causes a lot of trouble for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, what I thought was very interesting when I designed these two charts of in paper 9, there's a chart, forced expatriations per year from 1945 to 1977. And there's a second chart, renunciations per year from 1996 to 2020. And if you look at the two charts, it's as if they're almost mirror images of each other, because the first chart of forced expatriations from 45 to 77, you have a line that starts high and ends low. And the other chart, renunciations from 96 to 2020, you have a line that starts low and gets higher as the numbers of renunciations get higher. Of course, especially they start to climb in the years of FATCA's implementation. So that's what I found quite interesting about these two charges. If you put them right next to each other, they're almost mirror images of each other, of the expatriations going down and then the renunciations going up. And I think the point I hope that those two charts would communicate is that you have the same thing going on now. It's just a little bit less direct.
Well, Laura, I'm going to ask you, you know, a direct question here. Do you think people are being forced out of their U.S. citizenship?
Yes, and I think a lot of people who renounce, they have said that they feel that they're being forced out. And people have said, if I could still be an American, I would still be an American.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, as I've said many times, people are not renouncing because they want to. They're renouncing because they feel they have to. And I think they do have to in many situations.
I think look at other countries. What other country in the world, and particularly what other, I guess, Western country? I don't know if that's the right category, but has as many people trying to, you know, they're people who are living outside the country are trying to renounce their citizenship. There is not a whole bunch of French people. There are a lot of French people who live outside of France. There are not thousands of them clamoring to renounce their French citizenship. I would guess there's probably not more than a handful at any given time. How many Spanish people are clamoring to renounce Spanish citizenship? It doesn't happen because those people have no reason to. They're not being, you know, when they live outside their country, they're not being subjected to laws that make their life difficult because they're French or because they're Spanish, because they're Brazilian. This doesn't happen. It's just the American.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating that the United States seems so intent on diminishing the value of its citizenship, you know, depreciating it. I mean, you know, they completely destroy the value of it outside the United States. I just don't understand what policy reason could be at stake here. What could justify this? You think that the powers to be in the United States have any sense this is going on?
I really don't think they think about Americans who live overseas at all.
Well, so it's not that they don't care, it's that they don't care that they don't care.
Most do not know. There are some that do know. Of the ones that do know, they don't care. At best, they don't care. A lot of them think it serves us right. And, you know, if you're going to leave the country, you got what's coming to you. I mean, that their idea is, well, if you don't like it, just renounce. Which to me proves the point of what we're talking about. That's exactly what they're saying, is either deal with these laws or give up your citizenship. So they're basically saying, yes, our laws are causing you to lose citizenship. But I've sat in the offices of, you know, I've sat in the offices of members of Congress speaking to their staff members, and they have literally said, why don't you just renounce? Because that will solve
it. Let's look at the situation of Eritrea. Okay, and Eritrea's extraterritorial tax laws. Do you think it's more likely that America's extraterritorial tax laws or Eritrea's extraterritorial tax laws would incentivize renunciation?
With Eritrea, it's a question of how they enforce it as opposed to rather than what the actual taxes are. The taxes are fairly easy to comply with, but they use some questionable means to enforce payment of tax.
I don't know the word renunciation of Eritrean citizenship. I guess that would help them, but it's not really the issue. I mean, they can have bank accounts. They're presumably gonna not be dinged by banks like Americans are. They can invest. Right. They can, you know, have retirement plans. They can do anything really. It's just if they don't pay that tax, that maybe somebody's going to knock on their door and beat them up or beat up their family members.
Yeah, which is a bit reprehensible, but
yeah,
but it's completely different from what the U.S. is doing.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is this, okay? You know, there's all this complaining about citizenship taxation. I am not sure that citizenship taxation per se violates any part of the Constitution. But it does seem to me that the U.S. citizenship taxation as actually employed has reached the point where it is forcing the renunciation of citizenship and therefore in its application would violate the 14th Amendment. Does that make sense?
John, I have to say that there's an element of what you just said that I disagree with. You cannot single out people based on their nationality and subject them to policies that are more penalizing than you subject other people to. So I think a blanket statement, it's okay to tax based on citizenship. No, that you would have a tax policy that would include citizens for whatever reason is something entirely different, but that you design some law to center on and target people based on their nationality is, I mean, the Supreme Court's already said that that is inherently suspect and subject to strict scrutiny. And why is it? Because there's practically never any reason to single people out by nationality. And of course, certainly not if you're going to treat them worse than you treat others. So is it okay to tax people who live outside the United States? Sure. The United States taxes people who aren't citizens who live outside the United States. They do it on the basis of their U.S. sourced income. No one is saying that the United States cannot ever under any circumstances tax their citizens. But that is very different from, can we single out our citizens and tax them differently than we tax everybody else? And that, I would say, is unconstitutional. You cannot single people out based on their nationality.
Okay. See, the position of the, if you look at the Internal Revenue Code itself, I mean, I certainly agree with your sentiment. I'm not sure, though, that it does do that. You know, we talk about all individuals.
Well, we've talked about how, well, the code itself, no. We've talked about how it's in the regulations. And the regulations, taxes, it talks about residents and it talks about citizens.
Right.
There's no reason to talk about citizens except to designate people who live outside the United States. That's the only that's the only function that word serves. Because residents, citizen or not, are all covered under the term resident. If you took the term citizen out, the only people that would be affected by that are people who are outside the United States. That shows you that that's the only function that term serves, is to identify people based on nationality.
Right. So, you know, I think that's a very, very reasonable point. So I think what's important here is to realize that the only practical meaning of citizenship taxation is really to impose worldwide taxation on people who live in other countries. Would you agree with that?
Of course.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, an extremely interesting aspect to this because, you know, you get, particularly in the U.S. tax academic community, you know, you get them talking about citizenship taxation. And it's as though they really don't understand that the only meaning citizenship taxation has is in terms of applying U.S. tax rules, not to people who live in the United States, but to people who don't and are tax residents of other countries. So you're looking at me an entirely different thing, and it's in its application and effect than I think of them in its theory.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, you know, bringing us back to the point of working paper number 9, we have a constitutional provision that says if you're born in the United States, you're a U.S. citizen. You're given that by the Constitution, not by Congress. We have the Supreme Court of the United States clarifying that for that reason, Congress cannot engage in laws or anything else that basically strip people of that right absent their agreement. And what we're seeing here is that the evolution of, and I think largely, you know, the tax laws, et cetera, has made it so that applying taxation based on citizenship is forcing people out of U.S. citizenship, really for matters of survival, I think. Would you agree?
For sure.
And that is, I think, a summary of working paper number 9, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think yes? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. On that note, then, I would invite you to add anything that you think should be added to this discussion.
Oh, I think we covered it. What do you think, Karen?
Yeah, I think we've covered it pretty well. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's great then. And we will be returning with our discussion of working paper number 10. So thank you very much, Karen. Thank you very much, Laura. And this is, of course, part of it's really a seed initiative. SEAT stands for SEAT, Stop Extraterritorial American Taxation. And I get the impression that each of you thinks it would be a good idea to do just that. Is that true?
Exactly, John.
You read our minds, John.
Who could have known? All right. Thank you very much. Till next time.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Kara.